Cause we got the alternative energy. Right. Nuclear free autonomy.
And welcome to the Radioactive Show, produced at the studios of 3CR Melbourne and heard nationally on the Community Radio Network.
Welcome to the Radioactive Show. My name is Sam, and joining me on the show today is Michaela. Most of our listeners should already be familiar with AUKUS, the so-called Trilateral Security Partnership between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Initially announced in September 2021, the partnership involves two lines of effort referred to as pillars. Pillar 1 focuses on Australia acquiring nuclear-powered attack submarines and the rotational basing of US and UK nuclear-powered attack submarines in Australia. A detailed new report released this month on the British nuclear submarine experience should be ringing alarm bells across Australia. The report has been written for Friends of the Earth Australia by British scientist Tim Dear Jones. Dear Jones has a Bachelor of Science degree in Maritime Studies and has operated a marine pollution research consultancy since the 1980s, focusing on nuclear and radioactive marine pollution, causes and outcomes of hazardous cargoes and shipping accidents, marine hydrocarbon and chemical spills. Dr. Jim Green, National Nuclear Campaigner with Friends of the Earth Australia, said that the report reveals disturbing patterns of unacceptable safety risks, an appalling lack of transparency, cost blowouts and delays, and Green calls for the Australian government to immediately initiate a thorough independent review of the AUKUS submarine project, and this report should be important input into that inquiry. The report also details deadly collisions between civilian vessels and nuclear submarines, radioactive discharges to the environment from nuclear sub bases, and highlights the eye-watering amounts of money involved in the building, maintaining, and then disposing of these vessels, which have a fairly short shelf life. The estimated cost to the UK's Ministry of Defence to fully disposing of one submarine? £96 million, or $200 million Australian dollars. We spoke to Tim Dear Jones earlier this week.
What first struck me was the number of incidents, interactions between submarines and civilian vessels. And I did a paper for the Nuclear Free Local Authorities on that. And we found that, going round the various local groups who had observations and had kept records, that between them, they had catalogued several, well over 100 incidents of conflict, if you like, between British nuclear submarines and civilian vessels, mostly fishing boats, who, of course, are particularly vulnerable because they're trawling, they're moving along with their nets over the side. So if a submarine is submerged, they can't see it. And the submarine radar doesn't seem to be particularly good at picking up fishing nets. So there have been a number of very serious incidents, some of which have resulted in the deaths of fishermen, entire crews, where the submarine has either snagged a net, and because they're big, powerful boats compared to the fishing boats, they just literally pulled the fishing boat over. If they caught it sideways, so they capsized it sideways, sunk the boat. There was one incident where a fishing boat was stern trawling and a submarine ran into it and towed it backwards at high speed and flooded it and it sank. There was an incident off Plymouth where there's a submarine base at a place called Devonport where a joint Cornish and Breton fishing boat was sunk by a submarine apparently coming surfacing, doing an emergency surface underneath it and tipping it over. So, I mean, actually, as I say in my report, Tufoe, Australia, British submarines have never fired a shot in anger, but they've killed a number of innocent citizens. So that's the top end of the worst side of the scale. But then there have been a number of quite serious near misses. A couple of years back, there was a near miss where a submarine was at periscope depth and travelling at about 25 knots. And it nearly hit a cross Irish Sea ferry loaded with passengers and vehicles and things. And it was not the submarine that took averting action, it was the ferry. People on the ferry noticed the periscope approaching them on a collision course and took hasty action and changed direction, and the submarine didn't notice. And the trouble with all of these incidents is that because it's a matter of defence secrecy, It's very hard to get an admission from the Ministry of Defence that their submarines were in the area. So locally down here, just off my coast, a fishing vessel called the Inspire with three crew was sunk by a freak wave. And it was hypothesized by a lot of people, including me, that this might have been a submarine bow wave, a submarine just under the surface. Traveling at speed does create a big wave, and the Inspire was sunk. They were all family, the three guys on it. The two younger guys were drowned, and the older guy managed to find a somebody else's lobster pot boy and hang on to it for 11 hours until he was rescued. The vessel was a total loss. The MOD denied that there were any of their submarines in the area, but local people had seen a submarine messing around in the area on the surface the same day in the area. But they said, MOD were caught out then, because when the inquest came, local people went up and said, yes, we saw a submarine, but MOD denied any responsibility. So the inquest had to say, well, unknown causes, but most likely a submarine incident. But what that meant was that, and this is a repeated story, that nobody gets any compensation. So those people have lost their boats, they've lost family members, and they have no recompense in under law because of the defence secrecy issue. So there's that. You've got these near misses, and then, as my report catalogued, it's a number of times when submarines under supposed expert management have run aground, hit an island, and become stranded. And then there was one incident where a submarine ran aground on an island off the west coast of Scotland. A rescue tug came to put it off, and then the submarine ran into the rescue tug. So, I mean, utter chaos, really. And we have these constant stories which emerge. And they do get into the newspapers, but they never get any verification from the MOD that conditions on these submarines are so bad that people get psychologically stressed, and they smuggle drink aboard, and they're operating when drunk. They're taking drugs. One submarine, there was an incident where a guy ran amok with a rifle and shot one of the officers on the submarine. It's just not really a viable program. And then, as you can see from my report, when you start looking at the infrastructure and the build process and the cost overruns and the messing about and the not enough spare parts and having to cannibalize dead submarines to put in bits into new submarines, and it's just a chaotic scenario, really. And my report was entirely based on the UK experience, but I hope serves as a warning to the Australian government and those who are proposing the AUKUS program, that there's a lot of subtle issues. It's not simple, and there's a lot of problems down the line for anybody who takes this aboard, not least the issue of what do you do with your waste. And I mean, that'll be a big deal for you, because I know you've had the Pangaea prospect raised in Australia for, oh, let's host, we've got all this empty space, let's host all the world's nuclear waste. That's a crazy idea. But if you're going to be responsible for your own nuclear submarine waste down the line, when Australia has to dismantle its own AUKUS or AUKUS, however you care to pronounce it, boats, you're going to have to deal with these reactors. You're going to have to deal with the, if it's a PWR, one of the problems we have here is we have PWRs, and periodically you have to change the cooling water because it just goes round and round and round and round and round and gets more and more enriched. And, we don't even seem to be able to manage that successfully here, because periodically when they're draining the cooling water out of the reactors, they have a hose break or a coupling come loose, and then you have a spill into your local harbour or your dock or whatever. And once it's in there, you can't clean it up. So you just have to release it. And the merry assumption made by the government and the MOD is, oh, well, the ocean's big, it will dilute and disperse. And that's, all of us who live in nuclear states see that story being propounded. Well, it's just basically really just bad science and or a terrible lie. They either know that it reconcentrates in various ways, or else they don't, in which case that's bad science and they're just terribly ignorant and they haven't cared to look. And, in Australia, if the program goes ahead, you're going to have a dry store where you can store all this waste. It will get bigger and bigger and bigger. if you try and reprocess it, you will just produce more of a lower level waste, as we have done in the UK. Somewhere, somebody is going to have what we call a GDF, a geological disposal facility. Our government has been trying for about 30 years now to foist a GDF on some poor benighted community. Of course, it's never near the areas where the wealthy live or where the power sources are. It's always out in the boondocks somewhere, you know, and Britain is from that point of view blessed with having a number of deprived areas where there isn't much employment and the wages are low, and you can say, oh well, you know, if we have a GDF here, there'll be jobs, and there'll be construction jobs. Well, the construction jobs only last for a short while, and then the long-term jobs will just be sort of maintenance guys, blue-collar workers. The good jobs with the good money will go to the well-trained elites who come from some university somewhere and almost certainly don't come from the area where the GDF and the stores are going to be. You know, it's just inequitable. And then the other thing is that, you know, the big issue here in the UK is that central government always makes these decisions. They rarely make these decisions on a parliamentary bill. You know, let's have a parliamentary bill saying we will build a nuclear site here, or we will have a GDF there, or let's put a naval nuclear military base at point X and have a debate in parliament about it. It's always kind of signed off by the executive. So local people have no choice in it. You know, so if push comes to shove, nuclear is not democratic. In fact, it's highly anti-democratic because it's very centralised and very narrowly focused. If you ever get to that stage, your local people, be they indigenous peoples or the rest of you, they won't be given a choice. You know, it'll be something that's done and dusted. And then you'll probably end up like us. You'll have to, I mean, we have a separate police force for the nuclear industry. It's called the Civil Nuclear Police Force. They're armed and they have jurisdiction outside nuclear sites. So these PNTL ships, for instance, that carry the high-level waste from Sellafield to Japan through the Pacific, they have usually come with an escort ship, and the escort ship is manned by qualified mariners, but also by these civil nuclear police force who have machine guns, automatic rifles, sidearms and cannon. So, you know, they're a paramilitary force, and I suspect that if you would go down that line and have high-level and medium-level waste storage sites and possibly a GDF, you would have to have something similar in Australia. They don't come under the control of the ordinary police. They come under the control of the nuclear industry and the government. So they're kind of like an autonomous paramilitary force in a way.
One of the key things that's sort of mentioned in this report is about the abolition of the naval reactor test establishment.
Yeah, there you go.
Essentially saying that, you know, these submarines are being developed without the benefit of real world testing of the reactors and the cores. Yeah. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, okay, well, the Vulcan site away, way up in the far distant north of Scotland, well out of the way of seats of power and money, was built specifically to test naval reactors. That went on until quite recently. And what they would do, they would construct a reactor, develop a core type. If you've managed to wade through my report and read that bit, you see there's been a number of reactor cores developed for the nuclear submarine program, and then test them. So they would run them for usually around 2 years before they were put into the boats, so that you could identify any sort of problem. Very sensible process, you know, just exactly. If you're going to have a nuclear industry and have reactors, that's exactly what you would want them to do. You'd want to have an armoured, well-overseen site and test your reactors before you put them into production and put them into deployment. Very sensible. And that seemed to have worked, because there were a number of cases where, and I've referenced them in the report, but where they put the new reactor and its core under pressure and found that there were some flaws. And then they could go back. Now, by that stage, they had actually had those reactors in submarines. So there were a couple of submarines that they had to withdraw from surface, refurb the reactor and its core. And that's partly why we ended up with a succession of reactor cores in the PWR1s and the PWR2s. So I think we had three or four different types of core put into those reactors and those generations of submarines. So there was an occasion when they had to withdraw early boats of one class and refurb their reactors and change the core. But at least they stopped it before anything went seriously wrong because of the testbed reactor. And then the idea that, you know, suddenly out of the blue is a cost-saving exercise, of course, because the whole thing, as you can see from my report, you know, it's overspend after overspend after overspend. And so, you know, in Parliament, people are jumping up and saying, hey, you know, why are these nuclear submarines costing so much? You know, and one year you're saying so many billion, and then the next year it's gone up by 4 or 5 billion. Well, you know, so one way of saving money was to do this computer prediction idea and close down the Vulcan site. So they closed it down. They've not only closed it down, they've actually dismantled it. So it's gone. So you can't say, all right, it's mothballed. Maybe we'll revisit that and start again. It's gone. And, you know, that also, of course, is a certain amount of nuclear waste just from, you know, dissolving it. So it's been a complete waste of space and a creator of yet more trouble. So if they need to build another one, they're going to have to start again. They haven't even designed the PWR3 yet. You know, it's not even reached a sort of intermediate design stage, as far as I can understand. And they're saying, oh, it's all modular. We can put it together and we don't need a testbed reactor because we can do it all by computer hypothesis. Well, it's just rubbish, because you know as well as I do that if you're going to model and hypothesize, you need some data. You know, and you've got a completely new reactor going into a completely new submarine with a completely new core. So you've got no data whatsoever. So all you can do is poodle about with the data that you've got from the old submarines and the old reactors and the old cores, which you said, you know, we're starting from scratch again. So it kind of negates that idea. So you can't accurately model without accurate data. So if you've got no data, the idea that you can computer model it, I'm sorry, you know, the government and the nuclear industry and the MOD might believe that that can be done, but I have no faith in that. And I think most intelligent people would also feel very concerned about that assumption that you can do that and you can do it accurately and safely.
You're tuned to The Radioactive Show, produced in the studios of 3CR Melbourne and broadcast across the continent thanks to the Community Radio Network. Today, we're speaking to British scientist Tim Deer Jones on his new report for Friends of the Earth Australia on the British experience with nuclear submarines.
The new submarines that the British are building, the missile carriers, and I think possibly the Arcus, are going to be done in a modular basis. So they're going to make a series of tubes and then weld them together. All right. So one of the things that I have worked on for other people is civilian vessels carrying nuclear waste. So they're not nuclear powered, but they're carrying nuclear waste. And one of the issues that we discovered with one particular nuclear waste carrier that had a fire, it was carrying uranium hex, and it was in dock in Hamburg, and they had a fire on board when supposedly the ship was stood down. You know, it was the engines weren't running, it was moored alongside, it was taking on cargo because it was a mixed cargo carrier. It had paint, it had explosives, it had fireworks, it had cars with full fuel tanks on board, and they had a fire, and they had this uranium consignment. They didn't, at the time of the fire, they didn't know where the uranium, it was a container ship, they didn't know where on the ship the uranium was stored. But the cause of the fire was the fact that it was a ship that had been cut in half and had an extra bit welded into the middle of it. And that was a weak spot. So they had a permanent team of welders on board, welding it all the time, even while it was, you know, at sea, they were welding it to repair this terrible silly joint that had been made. It was a one-built ship, and then they turned it into a modular-built ship. So that's how the fire, because somebody left a welding unit running, okay? So just to show you how arbitrary the risks are, but take it back to cause, and it was a modular ship. And because they you know, hadn't built it in once, and it wasn't all integral. It was bits and pieces cobbled together. Now, if they're going to build the attack submarines in the same way as they're planning to build the missile carrying submarines, then that's a flaw to look out for with AUKUS. Because if they are modular, there's a weak point wherever all those joins are. And if you've got reactors in there and torpedoes, and, you know, it's the AUKUS are going to be a bit bigger than our latest current ones that are being built, the Astutes. And I mean, you know, all right, so it's not as big as a missile carrier, but it's still a big, powerful ship. And it's got a lot of forces exerted onto it, you know. And if you start trying to do a right angle turn, or the marine equivalent of a right angle turn, you're going to put a lot of strain on the hull. And then just supposing you had a modular vessel like that and there were weaknesses in the well and it hit something, because we have had, again, in my report, I catalogue incidents where submarines at periscope depth have been run into, not in UK waters, but been run into by an oil tanker. You know, it's just mad. And then I have seen no reference in the UK or in the AUKUS programme about how to deal with the loss if you should have a submarine sink with a reactor aboard, an active reactor aboard. Well, how are you going to get it up? Where's the safety? Where's the standby? Where's the salvage for that? Who's going to do it? Who's going to pay for it? What are the risks? I mean, you could write a whole report, and I've written briefings on this for people, but you could write a whole report on this, you know, just about the issues. You know, all right, it'd be one thing if it was on your continental shelf, but some of your continental shelves drop off quite quickly. If you go out off Western Australia, it gets quite deep quite fast, you know, and then you're a kilometre down or something like that. And just because it's a kilometre down, it doesn't mean it's isolated. And that radioactivity isn't going to affect the fisheries or run up ashore and get blown ashore, you know, during surfing episodes and things like, you know, big surf episodes. Which is one of the ways that sea to land transfer occurs. It's when bubbles burst in the surf, and they actually, that process actually enriches the level of radioactivity in the water droplets. So, you know, we got studies off Sellafield where they've looked at that. This is the nuclear industry have looked at it. They stopped doing these studies pretty damn quick, I can tell you. But the first few, they discovered that americium and plutonium can be enriched by about 200 or 300 times over the level in the actual water, you know, because that process of producing jet drops and micro drops in the surf, those bubbles burst. And that stuff then blows inland, and depending on how strong your onshore winds are, that will modify how far inland it goes. You know, and I mean, just as a point of interest, you know, I know that in Sweden they've measured sea salt after a storm 300 miles inland. So the 10 miles that my local county council found back in the 1980s, that was just a random. That wasn't, they weren't looking for this, they just found it by accident, you know. So huge, huge problems. And as I said, you know, about Coburn Sound, it's a really busy shipping area, yeah. You know, and I said in my report again, that we find these accidents, particularly these, you know, collisions and mortality accidents, definitely increase the closer you get to major ports, choke points. So, you know, if any, say, for instance, vessels going between Tasmania and the mainland, there's a choke point there. And, you know, so, I mean, I don't know if the submarines would use them, but if they did, that would increase the risk. It's just so multifactorial. All right, you know, so I know I'm biased because I am, you know, I've been working as a marine pollution consultant on a range of issues for a long time, and I love the sea, and I don't want to see it getting messed up, you know, but you know, logically, it just seems like an issue to avoid, really.
Yeah.
Why have a nuclear submarine?
Just with regular operation, are the nuclear submarines releasing radiation into the sea?
Yeah. Okay. Well, that doesn't happen. And that's why you have these closed systems on the water-cooled reactors. Because if you're tooling along in the ocean and you're releasing radioactivity, then the enemy can put down a radiation detector and follow you and find out where you are. So they're all closed systems.
Yeah.
But as I say, it's when you start to bring these things into dock for maintenance and repair, that's when the issues occur. And despite the fact that we've been doing this in the UK since the 60s, as you can see from my report, where I've listed and catalogued some of these things, those accidents are still occurring. So why are they still, are they occurring because of lack of money? Yes, at all the UK bases, there are intermittent and frequent leaks of radioactivity. Some get publicised. Some require persistent journalists and persistent environmentalists to keep submitting freedom of information requests. But eventually it all comes out. And I think Jim managed to get on the press release the fact that, you know, there have been some quite recent admissions of multiple leaks at the Scottish nuclear submarine base. But they have them at the Rosyth site as well, where they've got all the old and rotting nuclear submarines. And they have them at Devonport, which tends to look after our nuclear-powered attack submarines more than the missile carriers. And so, you know, you have a leak. And as my report catalogued, you know, there was an incident at a public inquiry. We were presented by the nuclear industry and the government with a paper saying that people living next to a nuclear power station had less dietary radioactivity, less man-made dietary radioactivity than people living on an isolated piece of coast on the south coast of the UK. But actually, when I was given that to analyse at the public inquiry, it was obvious to me that 23 miles upstream from that site that they said was the isolated place, 23 miles upstream, there was this Devonport nuclear submarine base where they repair the attack submarines. And the analysis of the radioactivity in the diet showed that the big influence was cobalt-60. And cobalt-60 is particularly associated with nuclear submarine pressurized water reactors, because it's the cobalt is extracted, eroded out of the pipework and the reactor innards by irradiation. And when you look at the published discharges from that particular site, you see that cobalt-60 is very high. These people were eating organic food grown 23 miles downstream, i.e. in the liquid fallout zone, if you like. And they were kind of people who were subject to sea to land transfer. And along that coast, it was traditional, as it is in still is in several parts of the UK, to use seaweed as a fertilizer. Very good soil conditioner, lots of minerals, etc., etc. And these were the people who had the higher dose than those people who are living right next to a nuclear reactor, which the government was trying to say, oh, well, this shows how safe the nuclear reactors they are and how perfect it is. But actually, what it was saying was how jolly dangerous the submarine bases were. So that's an example. So we're talking 23 miles downstream of a submarine base. And that's, you know, and that was as far as that study went. I mean, if I had all the money in the world and the citizens campaigns I work with had all the money in the world, well, we would say, well, there's a warning. Let's start looking further and further afield until we get to nil with that kind of thing. But as I said to you earlier on, you know, we found on the west coast of Wales, 200 kilometres from Sellafield, that we had Sellafield-derived radioactivity, not only in the shoreline, in the sediments, in the estuary, on the beach sand and in the seaweed, but also blowing 10 miles inland. So it's all a dreadful con. And, you know, the history of the stuff that we've got out of freedom of information requests and public announcements, after putting relatively extreme pressure on the people who hold that information, shows that there are frequent leaks from all of these sites, and the best white heat of British technology hasn't been able to stop them. This is why there should be a positive democratic input into this process, because people are being conned. You know, people are having this stuff inflicted on them.
You've been listening to The Radioactive Show, brought to you by the Nuclear Free Collective from Friends of the Earth Melbourne, with support from the Community Radio Network. The full report, The British Experience with Nuclear-Powered Submarines, Lessons for Australia, is available online at nuclear.fo.org.au/nuclear-subs. If what you've heard has concerned you and you want to get involved, there are a number of ways to take action. IPAN has a petition on their website, public call to the Australian government to cancel the AUKUS deal. Find this at ipan.org.au. And there's a national anti-AUKUS day of action coming up on the 21st of September on the International Day of Peace. Find or promote a local event at anti-AUKUS coalition.org. We'll provide all the links in the podcast notes, which you can find at 3cr.org/radioactive.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.